Welcome back. We continue on our old SAML all day sessions, and the next one is data binding. So I'll be talking about just connecting elements together and connecting elements to business objects, because we haven't done that as much. We've been doing it across element to element pretty
on and off,
a lot.
Yeah. And I don't know you guys, but we have a lot of fun, right?
Yep.
So that's cool. Let's continue.
Yep. So most people are probably getting tired. We're like just...
Well, we are running on adrenaline very much, so.
Yep. So data binding, just very quickly, right, what are the scenarios, what are the benefits? Data binding is nothing but connecting UI or presentation to data, whether that's data in other elements or, again, whether that's your business objects, doesn't make a difference, right? And the whole principle is when with data value change, the UI will change, and in some cases when data is entered through the UI, there's input, that also needs to trickle down to your business objects, right? And if it's for that to happen, it needs to be a two-way data binding. And the two benefits that I see, there's a lot more benefits, but the higher level benefits is just decreasing the amount of code that you write, right? There's always this code that I call the glue, which is you're writing code that just connecting a text box to a variable, and just connecting everything back and forth. And if you think about most applications, you can write a lot of glue code that doesn't have a lot of business value.
That's true.
And the other thing that you can do is, as you saw earlier, we talked about control templates, and then as we go right now, we're going to talk about data templates. So you have the ability of connecting these business objects straight up onto UI and having the designer really be in control of that user experience, having the designer be able to design a data template in Blend, be fully in control, and everything comes together without you writing a lot of code.
No, it's true. Recently, I did a little bit of Android development, to get started with it. And in Android, you don't have, data binding, right, which is really the probably kind of the main difference, right? So you also have an XML front end and some code, right? And it amazed me that I'm so used to XAML and to data binding that I had kind of lost track of, oh my God, how much easier it is to do it rather than having to go into the code and do this annoying listening to events and writing stuff and listening to events and writing stuff. I mean, this is not the code that I want to spend time on. I want to spend time on improving the UX of my application more. I mean, it's not a jab at Android at all, right? I mean, obviously they have a huge success, but I'm just saying that data binding are making your experience much more convenient.
Yeah, definitely. For me, I write a lot of Android and iOS and, definitely writing that glue is always that tedious task that you're like, oh, I wish I didn't have to. Now, it's not for everybody. So there's a lot of people I know who just say, look, I want to use data binding. And in order to do SAML apps, you don't have to go one way or the other. You can use your old mechanism. We're just telling you about a feature that we have that we think will make you more productive. And, we'll go cover the features and let you decide. So with regards to a binding is kind of four different components, right? And let me draw them all on the screen so we can kind of paint them here. But first of all, we need a source. So imagine that you have like a business object, right? And that's going to be your source. We need a path onto that source. So for example, if we have person and we want to bind the full name property from person onto some business objects, we need that. That's the path, is the property name, right? And then we need a target dependency object if you're data binding to our UI. And it's a dependency object, again, it's a dependency property that we're data binding to. That's the actual target, so that's the four parts. So pretty much everything in the UI, because they're dependency properties, you'll be able to data bind to.
Just to be clear, right, you can data bind to non-dependency properties, to normal properties, but it's not going to be updated if the property changes. So you have to be careful about that. You have a lot of value to dependency properties. Strictly speaking, you can take a standard property, bind to it. It's what we call a one-time binding. It's just going to be one time, and that's it.
Yep, it's just a setter. But at that point, you're setting it anyway. And again, the binding source over here, we're going to talk about that not needing to be a dependency object. The source is it doesn't have to be a dependency object at all. The target, that's where we would tell you, hey, we're kind of assuming that, and that's the model that we're going to talk about the most. Here's an example of data binding. You've seen plenty of these. So here, the source and the source path is checked, or the path is checked. The source is this element name, so it's a checkbox that's somewhere else on the screen. And then the text box is kind of the target dependency object, and isEnable is a target dependency property. This is the pattern that you're going to see throughout, and you'll see a couple of variations where we can have extra features on top of those four, but those four are kind of what required, right? With regards to element source, you can bind, just a source. You'll see me in a minute. Bind into a data object. We'll just call it a binding source. We'll set some data context property. Data context is going to be interesting because what you're doing there is you're setting a special property in SAML that actually trickles down the tree. So, mm-hmm. for example, if I have a page and it has 10 buttons, and I go set the data context at the page level, this is one of the few things that actually trickles down the visual tree, not mm-hmm. up to visual tree. So if I set the data context for something, everybody underneath me, mm-hmm. underneath it can inherit it, and they can attach to that mm-hmm. and data bind onto those objects.
Yeah.
So,
the data context, the way I explain data context, is really a shortcut more than anything else. So it because you don't want to always have to write source equals or element name equals, or if you want to save yourself the pay, the annoyance of doing that, it's not really a pain, but the annoyance of doing that, setting the data context is a good way, and then after that you have everywhere the same context.
Yeah. Yep. With regards to paths, sometimes you have more complex objects. Like, mm-hmm. for example, let's say I had a person who works for a company and you want to name of the company and you want to do something like, Laurent.company, right? Because mm-hmm. you're the object, but we want to get the company.
Yep.
So with regards to paths, you can do, for example, subproperties when you're data binding. So you can say, person.fullname, or you can say something like, again, person.company. You can also do indexers. So, for example, if you have an array and you want to bind onto item 6, mm-hmm. You can actually do, indexers.
However, be careful that the indexer is, once it's set, you cannot modify it, right? So it is only when you have really an array that you know that is constant, then you can do that.
Yep. So so that's kind of what we can do with the path. So mm-hmm. we have kind of dynamic syntax. Now, just like everything else, or like most other things, SAMLs, anything you can do in SAML, you can do in code. So for example, right here, here's an example of creating a binding in code. These are the exact same four properties that we've done earlier, right? In this case, we just say we create a new binding, and then we set the source to be our, for example, selected item right here. And then we set the path, which is the path to the property we're binding to. So in mm-hmm. this case, it could be person.name or something mm-hmm. else.
And pass is of type property pass, so it's not just a string, right? It has more things inside it in case you need that.
Yep, and then we attach the target to the binding, and we use this syntax. If you're looking at there, that's just an attached property, right? You're saying text block dot set binding, right? And then passing the property and giving the instance. It's very similar. Mm-hmm. It's the same concept.
Yeah, the way we talk about this text block dot text property here, this is what we call the dependency property identifier, meaning mm-hmm. that somewhere when you did the register dependency property, right, you had to say, you had to give it a name, basically. And by convention, we always say this is a name and then the suffix property. It's like a unique identifier within that type, which allows the system basically to make everything work.
Yep. So we've seen a lot of those, so I'm not going to give you an example. I'm going to continue going to bind to non-dependency properties so that then I can get dive into mm-hmm. demos. So, and the concept here is simple. I have UI and maybe I'm data binding to a business object, something that is not a dependency object, right? And you can data bind to any public property in a CLR object. Right now, the caveat there, it does have to be a property. So if you have an object and it has a method, it has a member, even though it's a public member, to you the syntax mm-hmm. might look, or to some people the syntax might look the same, but if it's not a property, we're not going to data bind.
Correct.
We're not going to be able to data bind.
And it has to be public.
Yep. If you have a property and you're not implementing like property change notification, we're kind of going to data bind to it once by default, mm-hmm. kind of just data bind to it, get the value out of it, and not update it as much because you don't have to. If you're not implementing property change notification, we're not going to be pulling it often or doing anything like that. You either implement property change notification or it's kind of a one-time thing.
Mm-hmm.
One-times can be very useful for a lot of
Absolutely.
Scenarios. But
think about the case where I use one time the most is for localization, for example. So you have multiple ways to do localization, but one possible way is to have your text defined in XAML in the XAML file, and then you can really bind to that one time because that text is going to be loaded depending on the culture at startup. But after that, it's not going to change anymore. So that's for example one scenario.
Yep. So we will update it only if you implement property change notification, which is what I'm going to tell you about. To implement property change notification, you have this object called iNotify, or this interface called iNotify property changed. And here's a quick example of what iNotify property changed. You're going to see me go back into code in a minute and show you a couple of examples of here. But here's just kind of a class called demo customer. And you're implementing this interface, iNotify property. This is too small. Let's just go into code. It's easier.
By the way, if you want to avoid repeating iNotify property change, nowadays I use INPC. And I say, OK, so let's implement INPC. And usually people more or less understand what I talk about.
Yep.
It's a mouthful.
Yeah, so let me see if I have any objects here. So I definitely have an object. Let's show you the object that implements it.
And it's already implementing that, so that's great.
Yep, I definitely have an object that's implementing it. So here I have an object, and it's going to be a person. I guess I should have called it employee, but I called it person when I was coding this. And it has, this is a member called full name, but it has a property, right? And it has another member called company, and you'll see in a minute that I'll show you the properties for them. And here's the two properties, right? Full name and employer, right? It's of type company, right? And what you're looking at here is you're implementing the iNotify property change. If you want to know what this interface looks like, all it does is this one interface that has this one event called property changed, right? So what happens is the UI is coming on and querying onto the object. So you implement iNotify property change, and if you're implementing, they're going to have this property change event.
Absolutely.
Right? And then they just subscribe to it. Right, so the UI is just subscribing onto it.
Yeah.
So when you implement iNotify property change, exposing it is not enough. You have to fire the event.
Absolutely.
Right,
and that's where the work is. And by the way, two words about iNotify property change. First of all, even though it's used in XAML heavily, it's an interface which has nothing to do with XAML at all. It was here already in .NET 2.0, I think, or even earlier. Exactly. And also for, I mean, you know, even before that, right? I mean, before XAML, because it's really a useful pattern. Yep. The other thing I wanted to say is that a lot of, when you create proxy objects, like, for example, Entity Framework, WCF, and then you have proxy being, you know, proxy objects being created on the client. Most of those scenarios actually implement iNotify property change as well. So you can really take advantage of that to build your UI.
Yep. So implementing it would be just adding, in fact, there should be a region here. So
here
here's a region for iNotify property change. So implementing it just requires you to, first of all, add the event so that you fully implement the interface. And then the more interesting thing is you always kind of have this method. Here's the pattern that we use. There's an always a method that you call from within your object. It can be called either property change or on property change. It varies a lot.
Raise property change.
It's protected or private, so it doesn't have to be. The name doesn't really matter. There's not a convention that, you know, there's not a standard convention. There's probably three different names that we use. But the method always looks like this, regardless of the name. You can have a caller number member name attribute. This
it's
is really
supported.
Cool because it's actually on the .NET Framework 4.5 and above. And what this does is whoever's calling, it's automatically going to get the property name from the method that's calling it. You'll see in a minute how I call it from my properties, and it, you know, and this automatically does the code. If not supported, you will just call the, you pass the parameter. I'll show you in a minute. And then what we do here is we just say, look, we get an instance of the property change event. We check for it to be null. And then we just call onto the method. So we fire the change notification. And the reason we use this pattern is to avoid race conditions. Right? If I could just call property change, new property change event args, I could get into a race condition. So we always hold a reference first. And then all we do is we fire the property change event args with the name of the property. So what you'll see here is that, for example, if I go to this, you know, person object, and if I look at their employer, whenever somebody calls the setter, right, here I could change if the value is different from what we had.
Sure.
But I was lazy about it, and I just said, look, employer equals new value, and then I said on property change. Now, if you were doing this on, say, WP or in Silverlight or somewhere where, or just using an older version like Silverlight 5, where this is not just supported, all I would do here is just pass the property name. So I would just do this.
Yeah.
And it will be the exact same thing. And this is going to implement the property change notification. And then from here, I can data bind onto that object. Right? So this is kind of where we're at. right? And for example, here, so let's go, let's just go into main.
Are you going to show that demo?
Which demo?
This demo.
Yeah, why?
You,
did I make a typo?
You deleted something too much. If you go back to the previous.
Oh, I deleted the change.
You deleted the raise property change, the on property change call. So, right
yep.
here, yeah.
I deleted the whole line.
You deleted the whole line instead yep. of the, instead exactly. Of the,
so we'll leave it like that. So you can see
yeah.
the two different syntax. Here, I'm calling it with no parameters. And what's happening here is caller member name is going to be applied because mm-hmm. I passed, you know, I didn't pass a parameter into it. So they're automatically going to extract it. The way to do it in if you're running .NET 4, 5 and above.
Mm-hmm.
And here I have it with employer. So you'll be able to see what happens in the kind of older frameworks. And then I had a couple of demos here, but I don't have one for binding onto here. So let's just go here onto main page and we'll add a few code. Because I had a demo for basic expression, which I'll show you in a minute. Then I have a demo for collections.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to come here, and let's say we add, let's just add a button, I guess. That'll be easy enough, right? And I can just say here, I'll add a button. And for example, here, I can just data bind onto it. So let's just give it a name. So I'm just going to say xname equals button. Oops. And then I'm just going to say, so content, which is the text that's coming into it.
Uh-huh.
From here, I'm just going to say binding, full name, because that's the name of the property that you know I want to bind to in the person. I believe that's the name of the property. And that should be all I need. And then I'll go back, and I have to set a data context for this.
Uh-huh.
So you see just in the designer when I say binding, when I said the binding, here my text went away because right now I don't have a data context. Uh-huh.
Yeah, because one of the beauties of bindings over setting everything in code is that because it's in markup, the designer is going to actually honor that. And if you set the data context into your page, it's going to know, okay, inside this object, there is a full name. If you have some data, some design time data, so-called, which is set properly, then it's actually going to run just fine.
Yep. And so what I have to do here is I'm just going to go in here onto mainpage.saml, and I'm just going to say these dot... Where's my keyword?
Mm. Oh, here I go.
Oops.
I was just sleeping a little bit.
This dot button, the data context equals, and I have a person dot. Oh, my keyword's just create a random person. So I kind of defined an earlier method that. Can come back here and you know just create random mm-hmm. objects. I give it four or five.
Now the beauty of that is that because we talked about data context a little bit before, here you set the data context on the button, but typically the whole page is probably going to revolve around that employee, right? So you could also go ahead and set the data yep. context on the page itself,
yep.
and then that's going to trickle down, like you said very neatly before.
Yep.
To trickle down to the button, and then everything is going to work just fine.
Yeah, so for example, here I can just say this dot data context equals person create random, and then I can come back here, and I'm just using buttons because they're easy to
yeah.
see.
And here in the designer, we don't see
something else. Like, for example, I add a checkbox,
mm-hmm.
right? And
yeah.
I'll do the exact same thing. It's a different type, and I'm just going to say this to be a binding of employer. Right. And now,
yeah.
so I have two different controls that are data bound onto the exact same source.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll just run this. And then that should be fine.
Mm-hmm. And here's the reason why you don't see it in the designer is that you set the data
yep.
context in code behind. I'm going to show later some techniques which allow you to take advantage of the designer even a little bit more advanced, I would say. But here it works just fine at runtime.
Yep. And one thing, so I made a small mistake here where I did. So you see here, first of all, it creates a random object, and her name was Jane Jones.
Mm-hmm.
I have this create random number generator that has five names and five last names.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see here, the interesting thing is that I did a checkbox equals, you know, binding to employer. So I actually bound onto the object.
To the
and
object.
I should have said, you know, company name, because we
sure.
know it's a type company. So here I should have said something
mm-hmm.
like, employer.name or whatever the
uh-huh.
property was.
And by the
so
way,
you'll see the default behavior here, which is just they do a two string on
absolutely.
The type. right? So I can go back and fix that in a minute.
So you could fix it by saying, you know, by overriding two string and returning the the company name.
Yeah,
for
by
example.
Default making a company name. Let's see what company has. So company right here has name. So I can just say employer.name.
Exactly. Right?
And while I'm at it, let me show you the next kind of, because I have a little bit of more basic expressions that I prepared earlier. So these are just all binding to objects. And so let's walk through a little bit of those, because this is a very similar demo. I just wanted to show you implementing it from scratch. But what I did here earlier, what I did here was I just have kind of a, you know, I'm setting the data context of one object, and then I have different bindings onto it. For example, I have two-way bindings to a C-sharp object. So this is the exact same thing that we just did. And then I'm also going to show you a couple extra properties. So I did the exact same thing, but this time I have the text box, and then it's the exact same source. You know, this in this case, I'm binding onto a resource. So I wanted to show you something like, hey, I'm binding onto full name. But this time it's not a data context. I just said the source to be a static resource.
Correct.
So I can show you syntax differences. Right, so I can come back here and do that a little bit. Right, and then the last thing that I wanted to show you here was I went back and, for example, in this one I have, you know, a fallback value. So for example, in this case, I'm binding onto a property called full name non-existing because I know that property will not exist. Right, and so what I'm doing there is I just said, oh, okay. I'm going to bind into a property that doesn't exist so I can show you how you can have a fallback value. So, for example, you bind to an image and it's not there. You can just put a placeholder onto that image.
Correct.
Or same thing for a fallback value.
Or think about, you know, the scenario where you go to a place and it says nothing loaded yet, for example. It's because if nothing is there, then you fall back to whatever content you want to put.
And let me copy this in so we don't have to do this so many too many times. So I'm going to also, the last thing I want to show you here so I can get through this sample is update source trigger. When you create a binding, right, you'll see it in a minute, but when you create a binding, you can choose your source trigger, right? So for example, you can choose, oh, bind to it and trigger the change every time the property changes. For example, if I'm doing a text box, every time you type a letter, that will trigger a change.
Correct.
Or I can just say, oh, trigger the change only when that text box is less focused, which is the default. And obviously, that prevents you from doing a lot of extra work. So you have to pick, you know, which one or the other.
I just want to mention that the property change value of update source trigger is only available in WPF. So you
It's available in Windows Store.
Windows Store?
Yeah,
okay.
This is Windows Store.
Okay, so I know that it's not available in Windows Phone. So depending on the framework, this is like the small differences that we talked about earlier, right? You might have a couple of differences here and there.
So, yeah, it's available. It's definitely available on Windows Store.
I totally believe you.
Yep, well, we'll see it run.
Yeah.
And I wrote this code like a month ago, so I no longer remember that I had a basic expressions one.
Okay.
So you'll get the code. I'm showing it so you can see here. So I have a binding, and I have this object, and I gave it my name. So what you see here is this checkbox right here is bound to this two-way binding here.
Do you want to zoom in, maybe?
Oops. Is it too little?
It's a little bit small.
Too much.
Oh, yeah.
So they're, the problem is they're far enough apart, so that doesn't help. I can make them bigger, I guess, or let me move them. I'm just going to move everything here.
Could put everything inside the view box and just blow it.
Well, these are all fine, so I'm just going to move all of them down a little bit, and I can move these two guys over here. We just need to shrink them. It's kind of a making sure I can shrink this. I want to move them here. Oh, I need to shrink this grid first, real quick. That should do. Now I can zoom in.
Okay.
I can zoom in as much as I want to there. So I'll just go back and do the exact same demo. And now, oh, interesting. Where did they go? Now I'm zooming inside. Here, let's do it this way. That'll make it bigger.
Yeah, exactly. Let's go full screen.
Yep. So now I can come back here, and I can go into basic expressions.
Mm-hmm.
See here, for example, this checkbox right here is not even enabled, right? It doesn't matter whether it's enabled or not. But I can start typing here, and because I did the update source trigger,
yep.
Every time this value changes,
it's
actually going to change.
Absolutely.
If I don't do an update source trigger, it would only change whenever I change the object, whenever I change the focus after the text box.
Correct.
So I wanted to show you update source trigger there.
Yeah, update source trigger, so you want to have the property change one when you do validation, for example. If your validation is not too complex, like, for example, do you accept the input if the user has typed 4 characters or more, for example, then you can do these type of things. Just be a little bit careful with property change update source trigger, because it's going to fire a property change event every time. So you might have a little bit of perf, issues here and there.
Yep. And then you'll see here, for example, the one with fallback value. The fallback value that I gave was Joe fallback, and right here we're not bound onto an object. So what you see here is this property didn't exist, but it actually put there the placeholder. So you can actually see a little bit of, you can actually see a little bit of, the fallback value there. So that's kind of where it's at. And this is just very basic binding expressions onto the iNotify property change. They're all the person type that I showed you earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's kind of how you bind onto any data object. Just implement iNotify property change and you'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I'll go back here real quick. We already tagged, and I'll show you binding mode. So I can do binding mode, which is one time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the most efficient. Go pick the property once. This is great for metadata. For example, like you want a list of the 50 states, or you want a list of, grades or something that you know is not dynamic. You just want a data binding, load it from a database and populate it in UI because it's not going to change. So you can do one time. You can also do one way, which is, again, in this case, will be like, the value, whenever the value is changing from the source, we're going to be updating the UI, right? And then the other thing that you can do is two-way, right? And those are the three methods that are everywhere. WPF has an extra method where you can go kind of a one-way to source.
Yeah, for very
where
specific
the
scenarios.
UI is updating onto the source, the UI is only updating onto the source. And honestly, that's not that different from two-way. Like, I live without that extra binding mode all the time.
Yeah.
I just do two-way, and as long as my code is not broken, everything is fine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what about the scenarios where, for example, here I have a border, and we said earlier, border has a visibility property.
Mm-hmm.
And the border visibility property is an enumerator.
Yep.
It can be, collapsed. It can be visible, and in WPF, it can also have hidden. And I got this class, that's a magician, and he's got a Boolean, right? So whenever I try to bind border visibility onto this Boolean, if I try to do that, first of all, I'm not going to get an error where it's going to crash or anything. What you'll see is the data binding engine will just put in on the output window for Visual Studio where you're debugging. They'll put a kind of this error message.
Error, yeah.
But they're not going to throw an exception, so you're not going
to
get...
And by the way, you don't want them to throw exception because the binding is really is kind of a loose relationship between your UI and your object. If your object is not set at the beginning, you actually don't want your application to crash.
Yeah, because it can be set later.
Yeah, so on one hand, it's big power, right? It's really, you have the loose coupling, you have the awesome power of that, but you also have, the big responsibility, which is that, okay, if it's not here, it can be a little bit hard to find the cause of the problem.
Yep. And there is way, if you're advanced and you want to get into it, there is ways for you to write a little extension that where you can listen to those binding failures and try to, but most people don't need it. I mean, you'll run into an error in your own code as you're doing anyway.
So the output tab that you were showing before is really where you want to look for errors in the first place.
Yep. If you if you have a binding and you're not seeing what you expect, go look at the output tab.
Yep.
That's like, there'll always be something there that says, you know, maybe it's a type, or maybe they just failed to find the property.
Maybe you have a typo.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
You put a nest too much or not enough. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. But you know, if this is what you intend to do, and you have visibility and you have a bull, mm-hmm. how do we go about it? And the answer there is very straightforward. It's converters, mm-hmm. right? So you can write this object that implements this I-value converter interface. Right, and then the I-value converter only has two methods. For example, here, if I was doing a bool to visibility converter, and I didn't do a lot of validation on this code, it's very straightforward. I can say convert, and then I'll just write something that takes right here. The value would be the bool value, mm-hmm. and then it just returns the visibility. Right, and here I'm just saying, you know, if it's true, then visible, otherwise collapse. Mm-hmm. And then optional. In most cases, if you're writing a value converter. And it's a one-way thing. You don't even have to write the convert back.
Correct.
Right. So a lot of the time, I write one and not both.
Absolutely.
But you know, for completeness, you should just write mm-hmm. both as much as you can. And what you have here is, if I want to convert back, I just kind of reverse engineer that process, and everything else the same. So I have a little sample here just to give you people or to give people something to refer back to. So I'll just show you this little code snippet. It's the exact same code that you just saw. Mm-hmm. So there's a converter sample, and I wrote two converters here. So I'll show them both, and then I'll run the sample. So here's the bool to visibility converter. It's the exact same code. This was the simplest converter that I could think of so that the code was very straightforward for people to read. Mm-hmm. And then I was also looking at the samples that ship with the SDK, and they had an interesting one that was kind of they call it slider to grade converter. And the idea here is, you know, I wanted to show you the power of, you know, the converters and how you could do something more interesting in UI. So here I have a slider, and then I'm going to give you the typical American grade mm-hmm. Values where, like, we grade from A to F.
Yeah, you guys love letters, right?
Yep. Yeah. So I'm Mexican, so I didn't go to school. I guess uh-huh. I went to college here. But that's just a little sample.
Sure.
So you're going to see this. I wanted to give you something more interesting with regards to UI, so you could think about where converters make sense.
Yeah.
Because writing a bool to visibility converter mm-hmm. is like, it's just grunt work.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that glue that
I told
you earlier. People don't want to be writing.
Yeah, this is typically one which is included into everybody's libraries that they use.
By
the way, so the person, before we talked about roles, and here it's again one of those illustrations, converters very much live in the UI. So really the person, the role who develops that is typically the person who takes care of the UI. And like you said, right, in that case you had percentage, so that's really the data object developer wrote in percentage, but the UI person said, well, it would be cool if I had, you know, grades as letters instead and take the time of writing a converter.
Yep. And so what you have here is this same page. There's a checkbox here that is actually bound to that Boolean. So for example, here if I check it, that border becomes visible.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And now here I just have a slider, and I'll show you the syntax in a minute. And you can see here, as I'm in the lower ranges, you mm-hmm. know, below 50%, nothing, like I'm failing. And then as I go higher, I can kind of like just convert the values. And this is just really interesting because there's no code. There's a converter code, mm-hmm. which is very reusable.
Yeah.
Right. And there's no other code that I needed here with mm-hmm. regards to my binding and with regards to my business object.
Correct.
So my business object knows nothing about anything. In fact, I don't even have a business object mm-hmm. here. I'm binding directly element to element here. Mm-hmm. So if I show you the code here, I'm just doing this. I'm going back to the... to the converters, and I just have this. I have this slider. Right here, it's mm-hmm. slider. I gave it a name, which so that I can reference to it on the binding. And then there's nothing in this slider. The slider knows nothing extra. All it's doing the standard thing: alignment, mm-hmm. margin. I give it a minimum and maximum mm-hmm. value so that it wouldn't be that far. And then here I have this text block. It's a standard text block. Neither one of these is custom elements.
Mm-hmm.
So here I have these text blocks, and all I did was I said a foreground, font size, and then I say, look. The text property is bound mm-hmm. To the value from the element name slider.
Yeah.
So this is the source. This could have been a business object. And then I could just say converter equals static resource mm-hmm. S2G converter. And again, to go back to resources, this is declared as a resource right here at the page level.
Correct.
Most of the time, you'll have your converters at the app level.
Yeah, because you typically want to reuse them in multiple places. Yeah.
But I kept it simple, and I wanted to show you the whole thing here, so you have the converters here at the page level. Mm-hmm. And that's all there is. You also see the bolt to visibility converter, which we have right there on the border where we say visibility equals reveal secrets, mm-hmm. right? So very, very straightforward to do converters. It's just those two methods, and you'll be fine. Now, earlier we talked about control templates, mm-hmm. which was the ability to change the look and feel for a control template.
Yep.
And here what we have is, for example, earlier we talked about, we have control templates, and I added this button that I just data bound to a full name. Mm-hmm. Right, and if I wanted to make that a little more complicated, like maybe have that button be bound, because I did earlier today, we did bind one button to full name, one button to company underneath mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. Right, well, I can merge those two and just create a data template,
yeah.
and then assign it onto either another button or into some other element mm-hmm. that takes a data template. Mm-hmm. Right, and all I need is for the element to be a content control.
Yep.
So checkbox, buttons, all the things that we added earlier will be able to do this.
Yeah.
Right. So
can do that is that content control has a property content template, which is actually a data template. Yeah,
yep,
absolutely.
Exactly.
And that's very powerful.
Yep. So I can come back here. Let's go look at that sample real quick. Mm-hmm. We had it on mainpage.saml. And here we had our button and we said content equals binding full name. Mm-hmm. So what I can do here is let's just first define a data template. And in this case, I'm just going to do it by hand so I can show you how easy it is to create them. And then in a minute, I'm going to go into Blend and show you a few more. So I'm just going to say then the data template, mm-hmm. right? And let's just give it a key so we can reference it.
Mm-hmm. Because it's a resource like any other?
Yep. So I'm just going to say data template is Xbox person. And then I'm just going to add two text blocks. And we'll use the exact same bindings that we did mm-hmm. earlier. So here, actually, just put them in, say, stack panel.
Because data template can have only one child, yep. but this child can be a panel
yep.
with multiple children. Yeah.
Anything that takes a content or anything that's a content control that can only have one child,
yeah.
all you're going to do is put a grid and then put as many children as
exactly.
you want.
Exactly.
That's the trick that you're going to be doing everywhere. Mm-hmm. And here I'll go back. And say textbook text equals binding, and it was called
employer.name.
Name.
Yep.
Yep. And I can go fancy here. For example, do foreground equals red or anything like that. So this is my standard. I'm trying to make sure it's readable. So I'm just going to say font size mm-hmm. equals 32.
36, yeah, 32.
Yep. And then we'll just copy and paste here, right? So this is my data template. It's a resource, so I can reuse it as many times as I want. Mm-hmm. And then I can come back here, and for example, in fact, earlier where we were just having the checkbox, and we were just setting, earlier we were setting the content property.
Yes.
So I'm going to get rid of this, right? And I'm just going to say content template equals static resource. I believe I call it person template. Yep, IntelliSense. See, now this is really nice.
Yes,
IntelliSense is actually coming in and telling me, oh, you have person template, right? And for example, if I do binding right here, if you look at the binding right here, it's employer name. And if I want to do IntelliSense there, you can see the exact same thing. I have my converter,
yep.
element name, fallback value. Relative source, and sources, everything that I could go in there and set, the IntelliSense works. That's mm-hmm. Visual Studio 2013.
That's very nice.
So here I have, this is just the button, and is it big enough? So I have the button, that's probably big enough to put that kind of content in there.
Yeah.
I'm just going to make it bigger like
well,
that.
Well, 36 right? is quite big, but
yep.
it should be fine.
And then let's just go see, and, if I clipped it, it'll be a good segue onto design time data.
Yeah,
so yeah, so you see right there, create person. The name of that person is Jane Jones, mm-hmm. and the company is Woodgrove, mm-hmm. right? So so you see right there with data bound using templates. Mm-hmm. Now templates against the button is not very interesting, but templates when we have lists mm-hmm. becomes really interesting. So
of
let's
course.
Move on to how to bind onto items controls. Mm-hmm. because that's more, you know, that's where we're going to be using data templates a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And I call it right here binding to collections. And, you know, I start with that. We talked about content control earlier and items controls.
Yep.
We said list books, list view, grid view, all of these inherit from items control, which mm-hmm. is we're going to use to data bind onto collections.
Yep.
And in order to data bind into collections, what we need to do is, well, you don't have to implement iNotify collection change. If you're going to data bind to a list box that has something that is not changing, then just data bind onto any list.
Absolutely.
Anything that implements iList or iEnumerable yeah. will be able to data bind into.
Yeah, think about the yep. list of countries. If you want to select, exactly. enter your country, and then you have a combo box. That doesn't change during the lifetime of your application.
Yep, and you don't have to do iNotify collection change if you do that. Now, if you do want to insert, you know, to kind of notify the list box whenever mm-hmm. something's get inserted, then you implement this thing called iNotify collection change, mm-hmm. which again, it's a very simple interface with just one event handler,
mm-hmm.
and then you do the work to notify the change when something was inserted. Now, yeah. a more common thing to do for anybody that's using SAML is that we have this object called observable collection.
Mm-hmm.
And this object, this class, implements iNotify collection change already.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever you need a collection that you're going to data bind to and you want to make sure that it's, you know, you're firing the changes for when items are inserted mm-hmm. or deleted, you just use observable collection. This is a generic type,
yep.
right? So you just say observable collection of type X
mm-hmm.
and then you can go back and do it. Now, if you think about it, the one thing that some people miss is that you hear notify collection change is just notifying you that an item was inserted or removed.
All the sorting yeah. order changes.
You know, so that's just, it's just telling you kind of like there's more items or less items or the order changed.
Yeah.
But for example, if I'm data binding to person
mm-hmm.
and the person's company name changed,
mm-hmm.
if they were already in the collection, that object still has to implement iNotify property change if
yeah.
you want it to come through.
Yeah, it's so, like a cascade, right?
Yes,
you have the object
cascade,
itself,
exactly.
but after that, this object has properties
yep.
which also have to be, I mean, to notify the
yep.
the receiver.
Yep. So that's kind of where we're at there.
Mm-hmm.
And let me go back and just show you a really quick example.
Quickly, since you're changing anyway. So in addition to observable collection, another class that people maybe want to look at, it's a little bit advanced, but just to mention it, is the collection view source class,
yep.
which is absolutely beautiful because it is really helping you. Because think about it, right? If you have an observable collection and you want to show it on one half of the page, you want to show a list sorted alphabetically ascending, and on the other half descending, then you don't want to change the actual observable collection. But maybe you want to have two views on top of that, and that's what collection view source does. I'll let people go and check the documentation for more info. But
yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, collection view source, to me, it's just the sorting. That's
yeah.
what really, like, that's
yeah, sorting, you can do some grouping, some...
Yep. You can create
yeah.
sub-views, kind of
yes.
like take the list of countries,
yeah.
and they say, oh, these countries are on this continent,
mm-hmm.
or create sub-views and filter them a
yeah.
little bit.
Filter
and then,
them, group
know,
them, sort them, more. Absolutely.
So
yeah.
it's a bit more advanced, or mm-hmm. a little bit, like, kind of, I wouldn't say more advanced, it's just more of a... tying the UI a little
absolutely.
Bit more.
Absolutely.
So I kind of kept it simple there earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But what we have here is, so all I have here, if we can see some of the SAML, I just created back here a list view,
mm-hmm.
right? And I want to show you the parts because this is where things are interesting, right? Items control, they always have an item source property.
Yes.
Right? In this case, I set my data context at the page level. So when you have a list view or any items control, you have to go in there and say item source equals binding,
mm-hmm.
so that we can go back and say, hey, I'm binding my source to
mm-hmm.
whatever my data context
yeah,
is.
Yeah, that one is a little bit confusing sometimes. So what do we do here, basically? Well, before we said that you have to set the source of a binding through the source property or element name or whatever, except if the data context is set explicitly,
mm-hmm.
right? In that case, we are going to inherit it.
Yep.
And then after that, we said another thing. We have to set the path of the property that we want to take. But sometimes you don't want to set the data. You don't want to set the value to a path, to a property. Sometimes you want to set to the object itself, right?
Yep.
So here we have binding just means that I'm going to have the source of this binding is the data context itself, and that's what I'm going to return as a result of the binding.
Yep. And then I use the exact same thing. So here I have a data template. So it's
mm-hmm.
the exact same, like this is a little bit more better formatted
mm-hmm.
Because this is going to use images. But I have the exact same thing that I typed earlier. So I could actually use the exact same data template, bring it here, because you see here he's got the same the two text blocks, right?
Absolutely.
So he's got a full name and employer name,
yeah,
right? And then all I'm doing here somewhere in the code, so this is my list view, and I added a button here so that I can add a person onto the collection, right? So that we can see the whole thing where we add an item into it. And what you see here on the code behind is this. So first of all, we have our class called collection samples. And then I'm just going to say this.dataContext is person sample list, which is just a collection that gets created on the fly, random data again, right? And then the one thing, when the button gets clicked for adding a person, I went back and I said, look, take our data context, which is sample list, and then just add a person, creating a random person.
Yep.
And then this is going to fire the change notification,
right,
and do everything there.
Yeah, which here is not immediately visible because you cast to iList. So basically here you don't really know that there is this collection change going on. But because Observable Collection implements iList, of course, they are very convenient. You can use also, it's also an ienumerable, obviously. So you can also use LinkQ to make some queries against it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep. So, and then the last thing I want to show before I show you the sample run is this. So this is really kind of, well, I'm using Visual Studio first. I'll show you in a minute in Blend, because Blend has a lot of great data binding functionality. But this right now, so I have my list view. It's right there. And I have a data person or the add person button, I can see it. But it's kind of frustrating for me that I have this data template, but I don't have, like, I can't see what it's going to look like.
Yep.
So one thing that I can do here is, Grid, or actually Blend, and our design time in Visual Studio and Blend allows you to say, hey, let's set some design time data context. And there's different ways to do design time data context. For example, one where I can do it is I can just come back here and say the design time data context for this grid right now. So this is not my runtime data context. It's just design time. It's just going to be, local person collection. So I give it the object, and it gives me some design time data.
Yep.
Now, this data right here is coming from an object. You can come back here to person, and you'll see that I implemented person collection. And it's just a little method that, literally on the constructor, just adds a bunch of random people. Right, so just say, hey, add a range from the sample list. So this is binding to the same data source that I would be doing at runtime.
Yep.
But this is only working at runtime, so I could make this much smaller, right? And this will not, because it's got the D attribute here, SAML will know that at runtime, oh, I'm not going to bind onto that. I'm going to have a real data context.
Yeah, maybe
set.
You can choose XAML. We can quickly explain that.
Yep. So all I did here is I added a D data context.
Exactly. And if you go up to the to the page tag, then we'll see that this D...
Oh, yeah, so the namespace
here.
Yeah,
so the D is actually ignorable. So you have MC ignorable equals D. So here, two things are happening. First of all, we specify that D is from expression slash blend slash 2008, meaning that, okay, Blend will know what to do with it. But however, we also say that the D prefix is ignorable, which means that the normal parser and actually any XML parser is going to ignore that. They are not going to do anything with that.
Exactly.
Only Blend.
Yep. So now I can come back. So now I have design time data, and obviously I can run it for real. And at real time, it's just going to run, full screen. It's going to run against real data or, more kind of runtime data. So I can just go here, and you see it's all just generated in random data, and all I had were images of you and me. And I guess this is too big for you to see. Well, you saw it. Yeah, it did grow. So you see here, the last one is Jane Jones.
And Jane Jones pretty much changed.
Yep. And when I add an extra one, I can come back here, and you'll see that, Lorraine.
It's me again. I win every time.
Tammy, yep.
Try five times just to see the... Oh, see? Dude, either your code is...
There's not a lot of randomness.
Here you go.
There's not a lot of randomness here. There's not, like, it's just sample data.
Absolutely.
And, all I do is generate a random number and index onto the axis. I might have put your name or your picture more often.
Oh, could be.
So I don't like to see my picture as much.
Yeah. But you don't care about my feelings, I know.
Yeah. So you're smiling on your picture, dude.
Yeah. I was.
You look like you're happier than I was.
Yeah.
I'm kind of grunting like, I don't want my picture taken. So that's data binding onto collections. Now, the last thing I want to show you, somebody was talking about earlier, and I said, hey, I'll show it. So I'll use that as an excuse here. So I'm just going to stop debugging. And this is the exact same project from within Visual Studio. I'm just going to go in there and say bind Oh, sorry, from Remisha Studio, I'm just going to go here and say open in Blend, right? And I'm right here inside Blend. And you'll see that it's going to open the exact same project, right? And I can come back here onto the, in fact, onto the collection. And let's do something so you see that I'm not cheating. What I'm going to do is I'll go back here into Visual Studio, and I'll remove that design time data source, and let's add one created using Blend.
Mm-hmm.
So I can show you some of the Blend features. So I'm just going to remove that design time data source that we had, right? And I'll save it. And now when I go back into Blend, the first thing you see is that Blend, you see two things. In the background still has the old data, but it's saying, hey, collection sample have changed. And this is where I'm telling you, you can go back and forth between Blend and Visual Studio as much as mm-hmm. you want. And it says, hey, do you want to reload it? And I'll say, sure, right? And then when I reload it, I lost my data source because, you know, I removed it from within Visual Studio.
Mm-hmm.
But here, Blend has a lot of really great design time data support, especially for people who don't code. Because for me, I like to code, and I create these random collections, and I create sample data, mm-hmm. and, you know, I can just generate random code. But if you're a designer and you don't code as much or anything, Blend has the ability for you to just create data.
Mm-hmm.
So I can come back here and just say, you know, data, and I can say, hey, create a sample data source from a class,
mm-hmm.
right? And from here, it's looking at all the classes that I had defined, and we know we had person collection,
yep.
right? So I can just go back here and just select person collection and tell it to add the sample data source. And if you go back here, you can see that it added under sample data. It added, and I had one from earlier, so it added this one, this new one called person collections data.saml. Earlier, we said SAML is nothing but XML serialization and deserialization of objects. So, for example, here, if I click on this, and if I click on this object, you will see that it's just XML. It's just SAML right here.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
It is actually XAML, yeah. So that's
XAML
what we were
right
talking
here.
About before. You can
yep.
use XAML as a serialization language.
Yep.
And yeah, absolutely.
And for example here, mm-hmm. so you see that the data is real. All I'm going to do is I'm going to change the first one to be Laurent again.
Mm-hmm. Again.
Sorry.
And no, that's fine.
Company name, identity, mine.
Yep. So that particular feature is very useful when you want to create prototypes.
Yep, exactly.
Very much, because you don't have, typically when you create prototypes, you don't have actual data. So you
yep.
just go ahead, and by the way, this is, you know, lorem ipsum, right? The
yep.
famous Latin filler data, which is coming. So that's really convenient. I would say one level higher is using what you showed, using the class, the person collection class, is really one level
yep.
higher. A little bit later in the MVVM part, I'm going to show another technique to also use design time data. But the point being that Blend is not just a static designer. It is actually doing code, doing things, and you can actually have it, you know, create data for you in order to improve your
yep.
your design time experience.
So I have my list selected
mm-hmm.
here. Oops. I have my list selected here, and I'm just going to go object. And just say design time data context, and I'll do this one that we just generated and tweaked,
mm-hmm.
and I'll click OK. And now you see I have design time data, and you
mm-hmm.
see that I didn't cheat. The one on the very top is Laurent, and
yep.
identity mine. This sample data doesn't have images, so that's why we lost
sure.
the image. But if I run this sample now, again, this is design time only, and then at runtime, I get the real data.
Exactly.
The images are still there and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I can come back here, and for example, from this list, I can just say, oh, look, on the list, very much like we did earlier, I can say, oh, edit the data template, which would be the data template for the list. So don't do that one if you're trying to, that's the control template, it's not a data template.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can say edit additional templates, and here I have the generated items list, which is my item template,
yep.
right? So I can come back here
mm-hmm.
and just say, oh, edit the current one.
Mm-hmm.
And you see here, I get a design time data like
yeah.
we did earlier. So for example, I can maybe swap the order where I have company name
mm-hmm.
first, or before name.
And the beauty of that is that you have really an in-context
yep.
experience. You're doing all the
yep.
all the changing, then you see immediately what you have with all
yep.
the data. This is beautiful.
And I can do full properties here where
mm-hmm.
I can say, oh, you know, maybe all the company names should be, you know, in red, mm-hmm. and maybe the font size needs to be bigger. Mm-hmm. So I have a very visual way of editing my, you know, items collections.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And this is the beauty of data templates, and that's mm-hmm. how everything kind of yeah. comes together.
So this is where I really Blend, and you know, that works into the Visual Studio Designer as well, by the way. It's not just Blend. So again, for our, you know, friend who wanted to do things in the Visual Studio Designer, that works fine as yep. well. This is where those designers actually come out of the concurrents and are really better than the concurrents. You typically have a designer for, you know, when you do UI in general. But having this ability to edit dynamic data or to simulate dynamic data and to have something which is really giving you the experience is really useful. The alternative to that would be to actually make your changes without seeing the result, running the application. Maybe you have to log in, you know, to log into a page and actually load the data, and that takes time. And every time that you change something in the UI, you have to do that. While here, you go directly to the page. You don't need to navigate anything, and then you can make your changes.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So that's it. That's everything that we're going to cover in data binding. We showed you, if you look at it, we show them data binding to objects, mm-hmm. data binding to collections. Mm-hmm. We show them converters, update source triggers. We talked about the error handling or the kind of how we
fallback,
the fallbacks,
yeah.
and how to look at errors. Yeah. So that's all the basics. And the whole mm-hmm. principle here is with data binding, you're going to have great visualization at the design time. Mm-hmm. You're going to have less code if you mm-hmm. want to use it. And again, the last one is, this is an optional thing. If yeah. data binding is not your thing, if you're watching us and thinking like, hey, that looks a little bit more complicated than me, I'm a total newbie, mm-hmm. Great, take your time. Mm-hmm. But this is very simple yeah. and it's very, very powerful.
Yeah, there is a reason why you want to try to understand data binding. It's really the power of that is really huge, and it's actually going eventually when you understand what's happening, right? It's going to actually make you save quite a lot of time. But I understand the learning curve. It's a big learning curve, obviously. So yeah, take your time, absolutely. Keep in mind, oh, okay, at some point, you know, two guys talked about data binding. Let's go and take a look and how it works.
Yep, yep. So great. So let's take a couple questions.
Absolutely.
We have a couple minutes, and then we give them a 10-minute break mm-hmm. So we can come back to kind of a sequential animation plus mm-hmm. MBVM.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because we're running. So let's see what we have. Are view states and snap states, are view states or snap states still exist in 8.1? No, in 8.1, because we added so much flexibility onto the windowing model for those people doing Windows Store apps, we no longer have snapped. Mm-hmm. So in 8.1, we kind of have sizes. We tell you, hey, the smallest size we can do is 320. The recommended that we want most people to go down to is down to 500 pixels. Mm-hmm. But honestly, on Windows 8.1, any application you do, so for example, here I'll launch one app, and then let's go ahead and launch another app. So I'll just launch right here two apps back and forth, and then when I come back here, my mouse, because I'm doing remote desktop. For 8.1, you can see here, well, this one's an 8 app. So let me give you 281 apps. So I have right here Musics, and then let me give you another app. Oops, I'm having a hard time because it's I'm remote desktop, so I can't get to the edges here. Mm. But let's see. So we have Maps, News, Travel should be mm-hmm. new. And so from here, when I go down to the edges and I click on them. You'll see right here, this is an 8.0 app, so this is still snapping. But if I didn't have an 8.0 app, you'll see that the window is actually resizing. And in mm-hmm. this case, they're detecting only snapped.
Yeah. What you want to pay attention here is that, so we talked about adaptive layout quite a lot, right? But there is a limit at some point where your application is going to say, well, now it doesn't really quite make sense to show the full UI because I'm yep. just too small. So before you had the clear state, which was defined, I'm snapping, I know that I'm going to be rather having a vertical experience. Now, it's really up to you to decide. So you want to listen to the size change event
yep,
and
exactly.
Select a different state. You can actually very easily say, well, okay, let's still leverage the Visual State Manager and think when this event is reached, I'm going to go to a state yep. of smaller or vertical scrolling, etc.
Yeah, what I'm doing, if you want to know what I'm doing on my 8.1 apps, mm-hmm. What I'm doing is actually defining four different states. Mm-hmm. So I'm defining the full state.
Yep.
And then I'm kind of defining, now in my case, for specific reasons for the app that I'm working on now, I'm kind of defining an 800 pixel state, and then I'm defining the 500 pixel state and the 320.
Yeah.
And then I'm using Visual State Manager to go across the three of them.
Exactly.
I just define custom states because Visual State Manager can do all the transitions across the layouts.
Yeah.
And for example, when I go from like 800 to 500, I go from a grid view to a list view.
Exactly. Yeah.
Very
similar,
like
suddenly you have the vertical.
So I'm doing that.
Yeah.
But this is 8.1, and you can see now. I tweeted this the other day, and everybody gave me. If you were actually doing Windows Store development today, and you're running 8.1 and or 8, really consider 8.1 just from the side that you'll be so much more productive. Like for me now, like for example, where I'm in like the email application, I can be on Twitter and click on a link, and the new applications open side by side instead of opening, you know, taking turns. I'm just much more productive with regards to having two or three windows open, because I have like now I have like literally a three monitor setup. One of them is always what we call immersive, which is our Windows Store model, where I have all my Windows Store apps. Then I always have one desktop, and then I always have one mail. And that's kind of like, so I've been like loving it. Like this is what, so 8.1, definitely huge window improvements.
Yeah, and plus don't forget that you can actually prevent an application of going into the portrait mode. You can prevent that, but you cannot prevent an application from being resized. Or from running on the small screen, depending on the device that it runs on. So you want to pay attention to that and really, you know, take advantage of those grids, of those stack panels, of those flow layouts, which are really, really pretty cool.
Okay, there's a guy, but see, I don't understand his question.
Okay,
he got frustrated and said, "Hey, I've posted this question twice, it hasn't been answered."
Yeah, we have
it's
a
the
lot
POCO,
of questions.
But it says, you know, it's a POCO representation of a table of some database. You can do that in ASP.NET by using item types. So can SAML support strong types?
Well, so I'm guessing, right?
I still
right?
don't understand that is my
no,
problem.
No, I still don't understand the question, but I'm guessing. I mean, bindings are, when you do a binding, this is a loose coupling, right? So you're not going to get a lot of you know, a lot of checking, does this property actually exist? And like we said before, when the binding, when you make an error in your binding, it's not actually to crash your app. So it's not per se a strong type. But the POCO, I mean, the object that you're using is, of course, strongly typed, right?
Yeah, but that person object that we use there.
Yeah.
So I think what he's looking at is kind of what I showed him was items control. With a template, and it auto-generated all the items. That's what ASP does, like, because he's referring to ASP.NET and item type, and it's the same thing, except for,
I think we need to work on this one a little bit more.
So Victor,
really,
email us
please
offline.
Send us email us or send us a tweet
with a
little bit more detail, and we'll be very happy to look into that.
Yep. There's a good one here. Tell us about SAMLPad or other tools to tell us to test SAML interactively.
Yeah.
So SAMLPad is a great app that Robbie.
Robbie did CAGXAML. XAMLPad actually was Microsoft. But if you go to CAGXAML.com, if you want to give me the focus here, you actually have this. Do you want to switch to my computer if you can? Here you go. So this is Robin Bretton, who you know, longtime friend and longtime employee of Identity Mind, who now does some really awesome independent work at Nerd Plus Art, and he has this this kind of note. It's a little bit like Notepad for XAML, to be honest. So you can try things very easily, and you can type your XAML by hand. You even have some IntelliSense access. You have a nice property panel where you can try things on, and you can immediately visualize what you do. So if you want to understand, this is a great teaching tool in order to understand what does XAML do really.
Yep, and the caveat with that is that it works well for WPF, and he added serialized support.
Yes,
but it doesn't work for Windows Store apps because of the model and everything else. So that's why we didn't show it. Now, to be fair, and I love Robbie. He also worked for Microsoft when before he was at
Before Inland, that, yeah.
And I love the tool, but to be fair, like nowadays, I find myself with Visual Studio doing everything I need.
Yeah, Visual Studio or Blend.
Visual Studio is getting so much better than now I can do it all. Like today, we did all of our demos from Visual Studio.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
So that's kind of why today we didn't show that one. But, you know, it's a great tool. Because SAML is kind of probably a more modern version of SAML.
Yeah, I think SAMLPad was really just for WPF back then, and it was kind of fun. But I don't think it's really used much anymore.
Yep. And then I'll take one more, and then we can go to a break. And then we'll come back to animations real quick. Is designing in Blend real-time translated to Visual Studio and vice versa? This was already been answered. I show you design time back and forth. So this is the one that we had from last time. So I read the wrong question.
Okay.
And what about the device-independent design?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what they mean there. So I'll ask. I'll answer a few
things. I think I maybe have an idea. So unfortunately, right now, the place that we are at right now is that you still have a different version of, you know, of the framework running for the phone, running for Windows 8, etc. So when you think about, and by the way, I'm going to show something about, you know, sharing code a little bit. We'll get to that. So you can already, you know, share quite a lot of your code, but then at some point you want to start, doing a design, right? Personally, I believe that the design should be, adapted to the device that you run it on, because you don't really, the use case for the phone, right, is not exactly the same. You have often like bad sunlight, etc. So what you can do if you want to have really device-independent design, right, you can just do a flow layout, a flow design, and then detect the size of the screen and, you know, run on that. The size of the screen alone is not enough, right? You also have to take in advantage to take in consideration the sheer size of the display you're running on. I think that the story is getting better and better, and I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, in a few years maybe we'll be totally there and not having to worry too much about the devices that we run on.
Yep. Well, so today it's two simul platforms. So I was curious what they meant by device independent, because the way I think about it is, if you're talking platform, right, like phone versus Windows, or phone and Windows is two different platforms, right? So platform is, right now we do have two different platforms. It's the same SAML, same techniques, but you do have to optimize your user experience.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about sharing code like PCL later, and we'll give them a really quick sample of, hey, here's how you share binaries. Mm-hmm. So I think on that side we'll get there.
Yeah.
And we're working towards that. If what they were talking about it was device independent with regards to, like, oh, for example, like that Surface, well, no, that's a Surface RT, but this Surface right here is a 1920, which kind of a 1080p device at very high DPI. So if they're talking about high DPI, then we talked about it earlier, right? So everything, all the units for us in SAML, we're using vectors as much as we can. So things will scale nice with regards to the actual elements. And then what we do is we give you the ability to provide multiple images.
Yeah.
So for example, if you have an image that's an icon, we give you the ability to give us the 100% or kind of the lower scale, and then 140 and 180. So you can go kind of to a high DPI device and scale well.
Because you want to avoid resizing, PNGs, etc.
Yep.
Also, another thing is the text, the fonts, right? So you're setting your font, but if you go into your screen properties and then you bump the font size, the PPI basically, then that's going to be taken in account, and you're going to have a better experience.
Yep.
By the way, since we are talking a little bit about accessibility here, also think about the high contrast design, where you need to provide a version of your app which is going to have a high contrast theme, so that people with visually impaired have going to have a better way to see that. Also, there are some mechanisms where you can have a screen reader actually detect. These are all the automation properties, dot name, etc., which are going to be able to read that. So there is really a lot of things that you can do.
Yep, and there's a lot of questions about the code samples. So I don't have a great answer for Virtual Academy, but what we'll do is with the videos, we'll definitely be tweeting, and I'll put a blog post with references of code sample, because a lot of people have asked. So we'll put a lot of, hey, these are really great getting started resources, and then we'll put our code samples, and then I don't know if Virtual Academy can link to them, but we'll ask and we'll try.
Yeah, and definitely follow us on Twitter, and we'll tweet that.
And
absolutely,
then we'll go. Great, so let's give people a break, because we're a little, now we took a few more questions, and then we'll come back real quick to animation and data and MVVM.